Good afternoon, Your Honors. Mike Pittenger, on behalf of defendant below, appellee Barnes & Noble, wanted to make a few introductions. It's my privilege and pleasure to introduce Sandra Goldstein and Kevin Orsini of Cravath, Swain & Moore. With the court's permission, Ms. Goldstein will be presenting argument on behalf of appellees today.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. David McBride for Appellant Yucaipa Entities. Before I begin my argument, I'd like to introduce to the court my co-counsel from the Bingham McCutcheon firm, Mr. Stephen Alexander, and my partners, Martin Lesner and Danielle Gibbs.
Welcome.
May it please the court. This appeal raises two critical issues under Delaware corporate law. The first, are agreements, arrangements, or understandings among stockholders solely for the purpose of electing three directors to a nine-member board a cognizable threat that a rights plan may be used to prevent? If not, then we submit the court below should have granted relief to Yucaipa with respect to the provision of the rights plan, its use of the provision of the rights plan, the beneficial ownership provision, for the purpose of preventing such agreements, arrangements, or understandings.
Are you suggesting that that's an issue as a matter of law, or is that a factual issue that may differ from scenario to scenario?
Your Honor, I submit that is an issue of law. I think the question of what threats...
I mean, taking those bare, simple facts out of context, a rule of law that says that's not a cognizable threat is what you're advocating?
Well, what we're advocating is that in the, first of all, we're advocating in the context of this case, but the first question as a matter of law would be, is it a cognizable threat at all? May the stockholders' ability to organize for a proxy contest, may that be a threat that the board can address? And I would submit that it's a question of law, as it was in, as at least as the Chancery Court perceived it in Airgas. Because in the Airgas opinion, the Chancery Court said that it did not perceive substantive coercion as being a threat to which a rights plan could be used to prevent stockholders from making their own decision. Yet it felt bound by the precedent in the Paramount case to treat substantive coercion as a threat. Now, once it's permitted to be a threat under the law, then there's all sorts of factual questions that may impact whether under the particular circumstances of a case it is a threat or not, how great a threat it is, what the board is trying to accomplish. But I would submit at the threshold it's an important question of law as to what a rights plan will be permitted to be used to accomplish. And I would suggest that the NOL is another, the Selectica decision is another case. There was a threshold question there, which I think is a threshold question of law. Can you use the rights plan, not for the purpose sanctioned in the Moran decision of allowing the board to use the rights plan as a vehicle to create leverage to negotiate? Can you use it to prevent stockholders from accumulating stock of a certain amount when the stockholders' accumulation of that stock would impact the value of a corporate asset? What the court said in that case, I think, is that is a cognizable purpose. Whether in these facts of this particular case the board's response is reasonable and proportionate, we get to the second stage. But before we get to that second stage, we have to answer the question, what can you use the rights plan for? And I would submit that in our jurisprudence, in Delaware jurisprudence, the stockholders' ability to organize to conduct a proxy contest has been a right, not a threat. It's been a right that the court has protected from the Snell cases that restricted boards' ability to manipulate corporate machinery for the purpose of trying to affect an election outcome, to the Blasius cases, to the Unocal cases, which have said that even in a situation where the board has an appropriate objective sanctioned by prior precedent, such as blocking an acquisition proposal so there can be negotiation, even then there must be an assiduous protection of the shareholder franchise. Now we are being asked to take the step to identify the franchise previously protected under law as the threat itself. And we submit there's no rationale for that. The argument that was made by the defendants below was that the formation of that group would be tantamount to a change of control for which a control premium should be negotiated. But that argument makes no sense either theoretically or on the particular facts of this case. The second issue in this appeal is, even if we assume the proposition that there's a cognizable threat, was the use of the rights plan in this particular circumstance reasonable and proportionate given the effect it had on the proxy contest and given whatever what you were trying to accomplish by using the rights plan, whatever the threat was, and in particular, the question, to me, the most relevant question that could be asked, particularly in the context of the shareholder franchise, is it reasonably necessary to have this impact on the shareholder franchise, which we typically attempt to protect? Is it reasonably necessary to have that adverse effect in order to accomplish the purpose, the legitimate purpose for which the rights plan is being used? And those, to me, are the two core questions on this appeal, and I think they're questions of important public policy in the state. They go, both of those questions go to the fundamental issue of to what extent will the law protect the shareholder franchise from unilateral board action that has an impact on it. Now, I think even in the abstract, those questions posed in this case are profound questions, because I submit in the face of Snell and Blasius and the Unical precedent, to call the shareholder franchise or the exercise of the franchise a threat is a tremendous step. But this case would be the last case in the world in which that step should be taken for three additional reasons, three aggravating circumstances. First, the stockholders are being prevented from organizing a group when there's an existing outstanding group already in place, a 35% group. So using it, this is not a situation where there's no large group already outstanding or that the limit that was set would be a limit that everybody would be subject to, an even playing field. This is a situation where the limit that's being set freezes in place the electoral advantage of an insider group. A 15-16% electoral advantage, an advantage that required UKIPA in order to win the proxy contest to get 72% of the vote, according to the defendant's expert, 72% of the vote in order to win if Alethea voted all of its shares. And if Alethea passed through the vote, the defendant's expert said UKIPA would require 74% of the vote to win. The second aggravating circumstance here is that this is a case replete with discrimination against the stockholder and in favor of the insider. When Mr. Riggio wanted to increase his percentage ownership in the company, the board not only permitted it to happen, it facilitated it by repurchasing shares. So his percentage of ownership went up to 35% the last time he had an activist stockholder. And then when he reached 35%, the board eliminated the rights plan completely. When UKIPA goes to the board and asks for leave to exceed 20%, UKIPA is told no without discussion, without negotiation, without condition, without explanation. Simply a complete and unconditional, non-negotiable, unexplained no. There are special provisions, and the other major discrimination is UKIPA is prevented from entering into agreements, arrangements, or understandings with other stockholders when they're in a position of being frozen at 20%. And yet the pre-existing 35% block, acting as a board, can enter into any agreements, arrangements, or understandings that it believes are consistent with its fiduciary duties.
Mr. McBride, was yes. The Vice Chancellor clearly wrong in concluding as a matter of fact that there was a creeping acquisition threat?
I believe so, Your Honor. It depends on what one means by creeping acquisition threat. Let me turn to the relief we asked for with respect to the beneficial ownership provision, because that's where this question is key. As your honors knows, the rights plan provides that that shares will be aggregated if there's an agreement, arrangement, or understanding, written or oral, for the purpose of acquiring, holding, voting, or disposing of shares. Now, all we asked, all that UKIPA asked for in connection with that provision was that first that the company construe it to avoid the impact on the proxy contest or amend it or to simply waive it as to this particular proxy contest with whatever conditions the company would propose to put on it, as was done in the Henley Santa Fe Pacific case, for these purposes, for the purpose of conducting a proxy contest, only conducting a proxy contest, in the next election, only the next election, to elect three directors, only three of nine, and so long as we didn't enter into any revocable agreements, arrangements, or understanding. That is the limit of all that UKIPA asked for. And yet, the board refused to allow that. Now, why? What was it that forming those kinds of agreements, arrangements, or understanding, why was that a threat that the board was justified in using the rights plan to prevent, particularly in these circumstances? In their final brief to the Court of Chancery, the defendants wrote what I think is, and in it they wrote this on the first page of that brief, in the introduction of their argument, they wrote what I think is the crucial statement of the issue in this case. They said, the board legitimately adopted the rights plan to guard against an acquisition of control without the payment of an adequate premium. And then they went on. Importantly, such control could be obtained in two different ways. First, a stockholder can acquire sufficient shares individually or in tandem with one or more stockholders to form a control block. Second, and this is the critical question, and it's a question, this is the question here, is this a threat? Second, holders can form voting groups in which stockholders who have already purchased their stake in the company band together for the purpose of voting on any of the myriad of issues reserved for stockholder approval under Delaware law. That's the threat. That's what they considered a change of control, and so the rights plan could be used to prevent stockholders from banding together to vote on what they're entitled to vote on. Now, why does that not make sense? Well, let's start with one fundamental proposition. When a stockholder elects directors, the act of electing directors, of stockholders coming together to elect directors, is not the exertion of control in the sense we're typically talking about. Directors under our law are A, presumed to be independent of the stockholder who elected them, and B, presumed to comply with their fiduciary duties. UKIPA would not control under our law, or certainly could not be presumed to control, directors that it elects. But let's go to the next step. We asked the lead director on the Barnes & Noble board at trial whether stockholders coming together for the purpose of forming a group for the purpose of electing directors was the type of thing for which it would be appropriate to ask for the payment of a control premium, because that's what they said they're trying to do. We want to prevent stockholders from organizing to conduct a proxy contest because before they do, we want them to pay a control premium. And his answer was no. It would not make sense to ask stockholders to pay a control premium. But here, there wasn't even control at the board level at issue. We were talking about three out of nine directors. Here, the proxy contest wasn't even coupled with any kind of acquisition proposal of any type. So there were, the proxy contest itself had no implication for a pending transaction proposal. In fact, it's undisputed UKIPA never made an acquisition proposal, a hostile acquisition proposal. But beyond that, what the proxy contest was about, and the court found this as a matter of fact, was a referendum on self-dealing by the Riggios with Barnes & Noble, a history of self-dealing that had gone on 15 years, culminating in the college bookseller transaction, which even the vice chancellor concluded that the demand was not excused with respect to because of the incident involved in self-dealing. That's what this proxy contest was about. But let's go even further. Let's assume that the law is going to take the extraordinary step of saying that directors coming together to form a group like this is a threat that should be addressed because it constitutes the exercise of control and because a premium should be paid. There was no analysis provided to this board as to either of those things. There was no investment banker that provided any analysis to this board substantiating the assertion that stockholders coming together to elect directors, especially 3 of 9, was an event of control that had implications for which a premium should be paid. No one testified to that. More importantly, this board never made the considered judgment, which is the ultimate question the board was confronting here. Is it in the best interest of the stockholders of this company to deprive them of their ability to organize a group, to conduct a proxy contest, especially against an incumbent 35% slate? Is it in their interest to prevent them from doing that, or is it in their interest to allow them to do that? Because, quite frankly, creating a competing control group or creating a competing group would neutralize the control that existed in the hands of the Riggios, and it would, if anything, enhance the value of the public stake of the stock. Nothing about any of that, which should have been discussed before the law of Delaware allows directors to take the step that was sanctioned here, they ought to at least take that step, and they ought to at least consider all the ramifications of taking the step and make their own judgment as to whether it's in the best interest to do it and why. As always explained in Moran, there was extensive board deliberation and evidence presented at trial for the proposition that hostile tender offers and two-tier tender offers were threats. And despite the fact that the pill was going to be used either temporarily or permanently to preclude stockholders from making their own choice with respect to that tender offer, it was ultimately concluded, both on the evidence presented at trial and on the evidence presented to the board, that it was in the best interest of the stockholders to permit that to happen. And I would submit, despite the fact that there's academic debate about it, that the law, that's been borne out. But here there was nothing. And let's consider how this would apply, this change of control of a formation of a proxy group. Analogize it to if we had an acquisition proposal and we were using the rights plan for traditional purposes. Well, one of the traditional purposes to use the rights plan is to negotiate with the other side. So our client comes to the board and says, we'd like to acquire an additional 20% of the stock to conduct a proxy contest. What are they going to negotiate with us about? The substance of our slate? What our platform would be? If they had concerns that we might do something subsequently, they could ask us for a standstill agreement. We offered a standstill agreement. They weren't interested. What are they going to negotiate with us about? And then let's take the air gas situation. Let's assume that at the end of this process, and here there was no negotiation, let's assume at the end of the process, the board can make a decision, as air gas allow, to conclude, you know what, we think the offer being made here is inadequate. We have a reasonable basis for doing that. We're willing to subject ourselves to the scrutiny to be applied by the courts with respect to that judgment. We've made the judgment the offer is inadequate for XYZ reason. What judgment is the board going to make with respect to our proxy contest? Are they going to evaluate whether our directors are better than them? Are they going to decide that, you know, at the end of the day, we've concluded that we're actually the better directors than their slate, and so we're going to keep the rights plan in place? It's nonsensical, Your Honors. There's no sense to this proposition. This isn't just say no, it's just say never. And the court accepted that theory. But it went even further what the court below did, because the court found an additional threat, one not even argued by the defendants, certainly one never considered by the board below. The court said that the actual election of the directors that might be nominated by this group, or the potential group, and by group, all we're talking about is agreement arrangements or understandings, revocable, focused on one thing, that the influence that those directors would exercise The fact that they was itself a threat, that the board might no longer be intransigent in the face of stockholder sentiment. The only stockholder sentiment at issue here was the sentiment of attempting to prevent self-dealing.
Mr. McBride, let me just ask you this. I'm sorry,
Your Honor.
Is it correct that your lead-in position is that it was improper for the board to put a pill in place at all?
No. It was never our position that the board could not put a pill in place. We never made that argument.
Then if it wasn't improper to do that, then we're talking about the characteristics of the pill.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it correct that one of those characteristics would have been to give your side enough leeway, that is, without triggering the pill, to get up to at least the same percentage as the Riggio group?
Let me answer.
Or is it something else?
Yeah, well, there's two aspects of the pill that are in place. There's the trigger level that precluded the amount of shares that we and anybody who had a covered agreement, arrangement, or understanding with us could acquire. So if the concern was we don't want to have groups in excess of 30%, then the trigger level should have been set at 30%, because whatever groups are appropriately covered by the rights plan, that group, that's the percentage where it ought to be set. If you want to limit groups to 30%, then 30% should be it. The second thing they did is they said, and we're going to count groups, simply stockholders reaching agreements, arrangements, or understandings. So our desire here was essentially to try to even the playing field with respect to the advantage, the electoral advantage that existed. And
so the pill should not have been, I mean, if this process were run the way your side argues, the pill should not have triggered in until the UKIPA people got their stock ownership or was able to get their stock ownership up to the same level as the control group, that is the director.
Not just UKIPA, but UKIPA and anyone acting in an agreement, arrangement, or understanding with them.
Right.
So if the trigger level was set at 30% and UKIPA had an agreement, arrangement, or understanding with Alethea, that would trigger the pill if the two of them held in excess of 30% under the relief we sought.
27 minutes for rebuttal. You're down to 3.
I understand, Your Honor. I will reserve my time now. Okay.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Sandra Goldstein, Crevel, Swain, and Moore for appellees. Your Honors, after extensive briefing below and trial, UKIPA has already conceded that most of the elements of UNICAL have been met. They admit that the board had a proper purpose, as you just heard, when it adopted the rights plan. The rights plan, they admit, is not coercive, and they admit it's not preclusive. Their expert, indeed, conceded they were actually more likely than not to win a proxy contest. They're not asking this court to invalidate the pill. What they're asking this court to do is both to allow them to buy at least 30% of the company and to be able to form groups with other shareholders without regard to the total size of that group. Thus, UKIPA's counsel admitted during closing arguments that the relief it was requesting was to be able to buy up to 35% of the company and form a group with Alethea. That way, they go into the proxy contest already knowing that they have a majority of the votes. All of UKIPA's arguments are based on a single claim, that the board is using the rights plan for the purpose of impairing a proxy contest to elect 3 directors. They argue that somehow this is what Vice Chancellor Strine found and that he sanctioned the use of the rights plan for this purpose. But, Your Honors, that is just not true. Here's what the court below actually held. This is a quote. The board's motivation was to protect Barnes & Noble from the threat of being subject to inordinate influence or even control by a block that emerged without paying a fair price for that control. That's the opinion at 35. The vice chancellor also found that in response to the threat that the corporation's stockholders would relinquish control through a creeping acquisition, the board adopted a measured pill without precluding UKIPA's ability to run an effective proxy contest. That's the opinion at page 3. The evidence overwhelmingly supported the court's determination that the board had a very good reason to fear the emergence of a control block. And if I might just give a brief chronology in that regard. This all started when UKIPA disclosed in 2009, in November of 2009, that it had doubled its stake to nearly 17% in about 4 days, reserved its right to pursue M&A transactions, and the same day, the company got HSR notifications indicating that UKIPA had sought clearance to buy an outright majority of the firm. So it was clear that Mr. Buerkle may well be trying to acquire control of the company. And the company immediately engaged counsel to advise the board on what to do. Counsel quickly suggested that a poison pill was probably the right answer given those circumstances. Within a few days, the board met. This was a November 17th board meeting. The board met to discuss the appropriate response. As the court found during that meeting, the board was afraid that Mr. Buerkle might try to seize control. There was discussion in the notes at 82602 of clear and present danger and creeping control. They were afraid that Mr. Buerkle might not be working alone. There was discussion in the notes again at 82585 of that meeting. What if he got together with other activists? At 82601, it says Buerkle could partner up. So they were afraid that he might seize control, and might be working with others. And they were advised by their counsel, Mr. Barchet, that Mr. Buerkle's M.O. was to get on the board through friendly means and then exert influence from the wings. And they were advised at that board meeting that they should adopt a rights plan to deal with all of those concerns, which they did. Now, in the months that followed that November meeting, the concerns only grew. Mr. Buerkle responded very aggressively to the rights plan, declaring, this is at B507, declaring that the board threw down the gauntlet in my mind, declared war. That's a letter that Mr. Buerkle wrote to Mr. Riggio on December 23rd. Additionally, they kept buying, bringing their stake up to 18.7% by February. And at the same time, Alethea, which is an investment management firm that followed Mr. Buerkle's lead in other investments, made its own run on the company, going from a 6% holding and being a 13G passive filer to a 17% holding, nearly tripling their stake and filing a 13D, signaling they're no longer a passive holder. So by the time Mr. Buerkle asked the board to raise the trigger to 37% in February, he and Alethea had collectively already controlled much of the company. And in particular, and particularly given the fears that they may be working together, the board reasonably denied their request to go up to 37%. At the February board meeting, there was a lot of discussion that focused on Mr. Buerkle and Alethea potentially working together. It talks, and I'll just cite some of the notes, B570-71, that UKIPA continued to buy more, 19%, another entity bought 17.4%. All of these things were considered. It discussed, no one has any evidence that they're acting in concert, but there's ample evidence that Alethea follows UKIPA, such as with AMP. That's at 571, also at B571. Don't know for certain whether Alethea and UKIPA are acting together, but, quote, every reason to believe. So it was very clear.
Help me understand the scope of this prohibition of agreements or understandings among stockholders, which would trigger the pill. Can someone agree, for instance, with UKIPA that there has been self-dealing and trigger the pill by having that agreement?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if that's an agreement, right? In other words, if people happen to believe in certain concepts, that's no problem at all. I mean, as is the case here, Yucaipa was perfectly able to go out to stockholders and communicate their thoughts about management, about anything else. That doesn't trigger, that in my view, that's not an agreement. Okay,
so
that doesn't trigger the
parameters
bill.
Of an agreement that are prohibited?
Right. Well, they can't jointly. What Yucaipa is asking for is to be able to jointly promote, as was the case in Stahl, right, jointly promote a slate, form a slate, and share the expenses. That's specifically what they're asking for. But it's to make agreements where they come together. It's one thing to say, here are my thoughts. I'm entering into a proxy fight. Let me tell you my thoughts about the management, why I think I'll do a better job. That's no problem with that. But what you can't do is have quid pro quos, agreements, arrangements, and understandings that say, if you do that, I'll do that. If you promise that you're going to give me my, your vote on X, Y, and Z, I'll put that guy on the board. Then you're united in all the ways that Moran and Stahl and all the pills since then, which have the exact same beneficial ownership language, standard, the plaintiffs have admitted that's standard, that's what you can't do.
So the concept of agreement is pretty much parallels the concept that's used in 13D
jurisprudence? That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's absolutely right. It's the same language in 13D. It's the same language in every pill that's come before this court. It's the exact same thing. What we learned at trial, just briefly back to the chronology, what we learned at trial actually confirmed the board's fears that I was referring to before. There was actually evidence that Mr. Burkle and Mr. Eichler met twice during this time period. They met for lunch in August of 2009, happens to be the exact same day that Mr. Burkle sent his first letter to Mr. Riggio, and they met again in January 2010, happens to have been the same time that Alethea was increasing its stake. Also clear from the record that Mr. Eichler admired Mr. Burkle very much. We also learned at trial that Mr. Burkle had reserved his right. Remember I told you back in the HSR in November, he reserved, and in the 13D, he reserved his right to pursue M&A transactions. Well, we find out that that was for a reason, because what we find out is that, among other things, he had pondered a major asset purchase by Barnes & Noble from Borders. He had contemplated a joint venture with Hewlett-Packard, and Yucaipa had even taken two meetings with investment banks about a potential LBO for Barnes & Noble. So it's not surprising that Yucaipa conceded that the board actually did the right thing when it adopted the rights plan. It's clear that the purpose of the rights plan was to protect against creeping control and a creeping acquisition, not to impair a proxy contest. So the only question then is whether the challenge provisions were reasonable in relation to the threat that the court found. And the challenge provisions, as Mr. McBride said, were the 20% trigger and the beneficial ownership provisions. So I'll start with the 20% trigger. First, plaintiff's argument that the trigger should be considered only in the context of a single election doesn't make any sense. Are they going to sell down their shares from 30% to 20% the day after the election? Moreover, 20% is a typical trigger. In fact, it's at the high end of triggers. More typically, triggers are 15%. Their argument is that it's unfair to have the Riggios at 20%, I'm sorry, to have the trigger here at 20% in this pill, because we have the Riggio stake at 30%. But that is exactly why, as the court found, Mr. Barchet, the board's counsel, recommended a 20% trigger instead of something lower. Again, instead of the more typical 15%. That's exactly why he did it, to account for that differential. And as the court found, the board specifically considered the 20% trigger in light of the Riggio's holding, because they understood that the rights plan could not preclude a proxy contest. And there is a lot of testimony on that. And as appellants have admitted, it is in fact the case that the rights plan with the 20% trigger, despite the Riggio 30% holding, is not preclusive. Again, they're more likely to win than not. Not only is it not preclusive, they're more likely to win than not. So all appellants are left to argue is
so
that
they did not, as a matter of fact, we now know.
They did not, as a matter of fact, and, Your Honor, I submit that one of the things Moran makes clear is that probably the most important part of a proxy contest is the message, right? In other words, as long as you allow the communication, everybody, they can solicit proxies, accept revocable proxies, et cetera, which all of that was found here, as it was in Moran, then what it comes down to quite often, as the court found then and as Vice Chancellor Stryan found here, is messaging. And if you can't compel enough shareholders with your message, well, then you're probably not going to win. But that doesn't mean there's not a level playing field. There's a level playing field. You just have to convince the shareholders that your platform is better than management's platform. And that's true of every proxy contest there is. So if appellants are right that you can't set the level, that you can't set the trigger below 30% because Mr. Riggio wasn't a threat to control at that level, which is what I think we heard Mr. McBride said, if that's right, then triggers can't be lower than the level just below control. That is plainly not the law. If it were the law, every single pill would be invalid. It would also mean, obviously, that there's really no concept of grandfathering. But very importantly, it ignores why triggers typically set at or below 20%. It ignores the whole concept of a trigger. And that is to provide the protection against undue influence or control that otherwise would be lost if two 25% holders get together without triggering the pill. In other words, a group of shareholders can quite easily get together, collectively exert control over a company, maybe even without reaching a formal agreement that would trigger SEC filing requirements or pill limitations. But if you raise the trigger to 30% or even anything close to 25%, it would only take two shareholders to do this. A 20% trigger makes it a little harder because you at least need three to completely take over the company. As the board's counsel to the board testified at trial, you're playing the odds on this one. If I might, I would like to turn to the group conduct limitation that Mr. McBride raised as well. So UKIPA has already admitted that the beneficial ownership provision in the pill, the agreements, arrangements, and understandings, is entirely standard. It's the same language found in hundreds of other pills, including Moran, Stahl, Unitrin. There's also no dispute that UKIPA can do, as I mentioned earlier, everything it needs to do to mount a proxy contest. Communicate, solicit votes, accept revocable proxies. Everyone can vote as they wish, right? The thing that they can't, clearly, their ability to conduct a proxy contest was surely not fundamentally restricted. What was restricted, what they can't do, the one thing they can't do is form a group. And the reason for that is very simple. A 20% trigger or any other trigger is completely meaningless if it can be circumvented by the formation of a group. That's precisely what this court held in Moran when it affirmed the Chancery Court's holding that the 20% restriction, if limited to individual ownership, would fall short of its intended goal. It's also why the Stahl Court, applying Moran, rejected exactly the same claim UKIPA is making here, that a shareholder must be allowed to form a joint slate and share proxy expenses. What each of those cases recognized is that to have any value at all, a rights plan needs to limit formation of groups. And very importantly, counsel for UKIPA conceded during closing arguments that the incidental effect on the proxy contest in Moran and Stahl was allowed because the original purpose for the rights plan was appropriate. And that is precisely, that's at A300, and that is precisely what the court found here. Yet despite all of this, UKIPA continues to argue that it should be allowed to form groups of unlimited size. UKIPA says, Moran and Stahl, they don't matter here because those cases didn't involve an election for only a minority of the board. But, Your Honors, that's wrong. Yes, it's one election, but there's another one next year, and they can get control of the board then. And if they're saying this isn't meaningful, then that means they're saying a rights plan is unreasonable any time a company has a staggered board. But we know that that's not true. It doesn't matter that a pill will take two elections to oust the board. That doesn't make a pill unreasonable. That is exactly what this court found not long ago in Selectica. But well beyond that, here's what I think is unclear, perhaps, to plaintiffs. Control is lost long before that second election. The control is lost when UKIPA forms a group with other shareholders. It's not as though that group is going to disappear the day after the election. It blinks a commercial reality to assume that once the group is formed, once they go public as a group and jointly fund and promote a slate, that they will just dissolve the day after the election. Instead, it is perfectly reasonable for the board to fear that the group would continue to exist either formally or informally with whatever agreements or quid pro quos they have made, and that would fundamentally change the dynamics of the company. That group would have the power to block the board from taking steps that the board believed were in the best interest of the minority shareholders. The key to this is leverage. The board will lose all leverage the minute the group is formed. And the entire purpose of a rights plan is to preserve that leverage for the board and to make sure that if a shareholder like UKIPA wants power, they pay a premium for it. That is exactly why the board adopted the rights plan here, and it is exactly why the rights plan is reasonable. And again, that is exactly what the court held below. It said it was reasonable, non-preclusive action to ensure that an activist like UKIPA did not amass, either singularly or in concert with another large stockholder, an effective control block that would allow it to make proposals under conditions in which it wielded great leverage to seek advantage for itself at the expense of other investors. And that's at page 68 and 69 of the opinion. If UKIPA wants to control the direction of the company without needing to convince a majority of the shareholders that it's right, then it has to pay them an appropriate premium. The rights plan is in place precisely to ensure that the board is able to extract that appropriate premium. Your Honors, have any other questions? I thank the court, and I respectfully submit that the court should affirm the Court of Chancery's decision below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, two issues. What was the purpose for the use of the rights plan to prevent UKIPA from entering into agreements, arrangements, or understandings with other stockholders? And all we asked for leave to do is agreements, arrangements, or understanding to conduct a proxy contest at the next election for three people.
Well, the other side says that you can do that under this rights plan.
No, we can't, Your Honor. What they said we could do is we can talk all we want to the stockholders. But if we go to a stockholder and we say, we want you to vote for us, and the stockholder says, well, you know what, I'm willing to vote for you, but I want a commitment. As a condition to my vote, I want a commitment from you that you will put in place special procedures to deal with self-dealing transactions between the corporation and its controlling stockholders. I want your commitment that you put that kind of governance structure in place. And if you agree, and if you commit to do that, I'll agree to vote for you, and we'll have an understanding that I'm going to vote for you. And we'll have an understanding you're going to put that governance structure in place. That would trigger the rights plans if the two stockholders who reached that agreement and arrangement had more than 20% of the stock. If we went to a stockholder like Alethea and said, we understand that you don't vote your own shares and your investors vote your shares, and we have no chance of winning this proxy contest unless those shares are voted, and we would like a commitment from you that you will agree to go to your investors and advocate for our slate, and we would like a commitment from you that you will do everything within your power to facilitate the voting of those shares. And to the extent you have shares out on loan that won't be voted, we want you to agree to bring those shares in. And if they were to say to us, well, look, you know, we need a little help to, we're going to have some expenses with this. Will you share those expenses with us? We're going to have to write, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, we'll share the expenses. Pill trigger. That's what's at issue here. Is it a proper purpose for a board to say, this is a threat for these stockholders to enter into these agreements and arrangements and understandings for the simple and sole purpose, because this is the only relief we asked for, so it was the only thing at issue, for the simple and sole purpose of being able to try to cobble together an alliance for the purpose of that one election and only that election. We didn't ask for anything else. And by the way, had UKIPA entered into an agreement, arrangement, or understanding with Alathea for the purpose of doing a leverage buyout later, or for any purpose having to do with acquiring, disposing, or holding of shares, and if the relief we had been asked for had been granted, pill triggered. The only agreement, arrangement, or understanding we could have done under the relief we sought, both from the board and the court, was the type of thing I'm describing to Your Honor. Is that proper? Is that a threat for stockholders to be able to do that? I submit, Your Honor, to sustain this appeal on these facts in particular, is to open the door to boards declaring that stockholders trying to work together to exercise their franchise is a threat that the board can use its unilateral power to suppress.
Mr. McGraw?
Yes?
You're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I
was trying to find a break in your sentence, but I couldn't find it. I appreciate your passion, but the red light is on.
All right, Your Honor. There's never been a break in my sentence from the day I was born, so.
Thank you very much, counsel, for a wonderful argument. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.